Thanks for joining us. My name is Ibrahim Sani. Very recently, there is a plan coming out of China by the NDRC, or the National Development and Reform Commission of China, that was tabled at the China's National People's Congress that includes the Belt and Road Initiative. The idea here is, of course, there would be a rethink on how China plans to execute the BRI plans, or Belt and Road Initiative. And we need to understand a little bit better, or unpack this a little bit better, about how this impacts not just the ASEAN countries, but Malaysia in general. Joining us is Brian Lee, economist at Maybank Investment Banking Group, because of the report that Maybank Investment Banking Group has published called Small But Beautiful. In the report, it shows that the China's decade-old Belt and Road Initiative has scaled back their ambitions to build what they call small but beautiful projects, following the NDRC's annual plan that was tabled at the NPC, or the National People's Congress. China's reopening will revive investments into ASEAN after 3 years of sluggish investments. Following the pandemic, we're looking at the lending by China's top two development banks, Exim Bank and CDB, plunging to a 13-year low, 3.7 billion US dollars, pardon me, for 2021. Investment into construction contracts from China into ASEAN has recovered, however, in 2022, rising to 18.6 billion last year compared to 10 billion US 2 years ago in 2021. But of course, this remains well below the pre-pandemic levels of the 5 years stretching between 2015 to 2019 at about 28 billion US dollars. So, Brian, maybe you can tell us about the Belt and Road Initiative rethinking of their ambitions. Is China still bullish when it comes to building the Belt and Road Initiative now, considering that a lot of things have changed moving forward, Brian?
Yeah, I mean, we do think that the Belt and Road Initiative, China will continue with the Belt and Road Initiative. Ultimately, I think during the pandemic, projects were disrupted because Chinese workers couldn't travel to overseas construction sites. Also because Chinese firms could not travel overseas to negotiate and evaluate deals. But I think going forward with China's reopening, there will be a recovery. But probably not to the peak levels that we have seen in the past, because I think while this initiative is still considered very strategically important initiative to China, I think the shift of the focus has become more strategic and more smaller scale. That's why the title of our report, Small and Beautiful. So it would be about smaller scale projects taking on less debt, strengthening risk control for Chinese banks with smaller projects, and also with the debt serviceability concerns, with loans provided to countries with limited ability to repay. And also, I guess you will see the Belt and Road Initiative move towards softer, less, you know, hard infrastructure mega projects, but more emerging and future-ready fields like environment and digital.
Brian, why the change? We know now what the change is, but why the change?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, it's I think there are a few reasons. So, for one thing, I think with the mega infrastructure projects of the past, Chinese banks have been exposed to, debt distress of other developing countries. So if a shift to small projects represents, helping to diversify the exposure of Chinese banks more, so that there's less of the debt serviceability concerns associated with a particular mega project. And also they will be more selective with which countries and what kind of BRI projects to go with going forward in terms of, you know, the ability to repay and the economic returns that can be generated. So that would actually help to ensure that that the risk control is strengthened as well. And also, as China shifts its focus to build up its economy post-pandemic, there could be a shift towards domestic growth. And this could represent a desire to reduce overseas spending as well.
Okay, we know that the Belt and Road Initiative is going to connect about 70 countries, but six out of the top 15 investments into BRI countries in 2022 were in ASEAN, including the Silk Road Fund's $3 billion commitment in Indonesia's Sovereign Wealth Fund and Power China's joint venture with Thailand's Bang Chak Corporation to build a $1.5 billion wind farm in Laos, for instance. Do you feel that these kind of countries will be still a net benefactor in terms of China's investments into these kind of countries? Or is there a rethinking into how ASEAN countries, the top 6 out of 15, for instance, are going to expect investments from China moving forward now that China's going to be scaling back the size of investments into these countries?
I mean, I think that ASEAN remains a high priority in China's, you know, so-called neighborhood diplomacy. If you look at the figures, for instance, China has been seeking to deepen cooperation with ASEAN. If you look at the in terms of trading partner, ASEAN has overtaken US and EU to become top trading partner for China. I think that going forward, I am and our team is bullish on more BRI investments in ASEAN and strengthen focus of China to ASEAN. I think in terms of benefiting from BRI investments, ASEAN will remain a significant beneficiary and it will remain a strategic partner for China. I think that's it. BRI projects in the past haven't gone completely smoothly as well. I think there are concerns if you look at the social impact. We look at the impact of relocation of rural communities. We look at the environmental impact as well. And also like in terms of public sentiment, because all these concerns about environmental, debt serviceability, social impact has actually kind of dampened public sentiment towards the BRI. So yeah, I mean, we have to see how that actually plays out going forward as well. Yeah.
What about soft power that China tries to exuberate, considering that the US is also doing the same in terms of enlarging their soft power, especially in ASEAN? Do you think that the Belt and Road Initiative, now scaled back, is going to continue to expound on China's soft power capacity and influence here in ASEAN?
Sure, because I mean, even as you scale back and move towards smaller projects, it doesn't mean that the projects are less important. It just means that you are shifting away from infrastructure, hard infrastructure projects, but you're still shifting to, you know, emerging fields like electric vehicles, digital transformation, and also in terms of like renewable energy and all that. And that in a way, I mean, the future-ready and strategic kind of approach, I don't think that actually pales in comparison to infrastructure projects of the past when you look at like enhancing soft power. And I think, you know, beyond the BRI, China is seeking more cooperation. Like, for instance, there is this initiative called the Global Development Initiative, launched in September 2021. And this is a state-led development assistance initiative where ASEAN is actually the largest regional beneficiary of the first batch of the project pool. That's a total of 14 out of 50 projects, almost 30%, focusing on poverty alleviation, pandemic management, food security, climate change, and green development.
You know, when we talk about many of these ASEAN countries, as well as the 70 countries that connects Belt and Road Initiative, not many countries have the same starting position. Some countries are deprived of these construction development infra projects like energy, rail, roads. Many other countries are reaching that level of construction completeness. Instead, they're looking at what you mentioned just now, technology, health, finance, real estate, entertainment, renewables, energy, and more. Because of this, do you feel that the countries that do not have good infrastructure just yet is now not going to be expecting the kind of investments coming in from China to build their construction contracts, especially in road, rail, and energy?
Well, I think it really, it doesn't mean that China will completely stop, you know, all the mega infrastructure projects. Doesn't mean it will stop really building roads, stop building rails. I think it just means that it's more selective in terms of its investments. So, for instance, if you look at Malaysia, the East Coast Rail Link project, that's still ongoing. And if you look at other countries as well, Laos, most recently, there was the China-Laos Railway, which was completed in 2021. So I mean, that is and I guess China's this narrative from China about kind of like scaling back small but beautiful, this is not an entirely new narrative. I mean, it has been in place for, even then you have still seen, you know, strategic construction projects going on, strategic infrastructure projects going on. So I guess it may not hold fast and true for all. I think that China does have an interest in really, you know, diversifying its trade and, you know, increasing trade with ASEAN. In order to do that, you kind of need to fill the infrastructure gaps in these countries, because many of these developing countries still do not have the best infrastructure. And when you enhance infrastructure, you can enhance trade opportunities as well, facilitate trade. And I think that's what China would like as well. Yep.
Okay, there are two terms that currently is being bandied about, including that of the digital Silk Road, as well as the health Silk Road, for instance. Do you feel that these are the items that is going to be looked forward and invested heavily by China to build digital facilities as well as healthcare facilities, including that of, say, for instance, improving the vaccination programs and all the other stuff that is in between when it comes to the Health Silk Road? How do you feel the Digital Silk Road and Health Silk Road is going to sit now that the NDRC has committed to the new scaled back plan of the Belt Road Initiative?
Yeah, I mean, I think for Digital Silk Road, I think that very much remains quite a priority for China going forward. Because I mean, even as they say small and beautiful, but at the same time they are really pushing, you know, the initiative of Digital Silk Road, Green Silk Road, and all that, and also Health Silk Road. In Thailand, they are working on and on you know, enhancing smart city capabilities, looking at building up Thailand's e-commerce capabilities. Enhancing digital trade will be important as well. And ultimately, it's also if you build up the digital capabilities of other countries, they actually can help to create more opportunities for Chinese companies to in these countries as well. Yeah, I mean, for health, I think that that I guess going forward, if you look at the context of aging population and demographics in some other countries, especially in certain parts of Asia, like especially Thailand has an aging population. I think that health-wise, I mean, it's always going to be an important initiative going forward, but there's also, I guess, if you like, a little bit of pandemic dynamics over there, because part of the health cooperation also was, you know, for instance, providing vaccines, vaccine donations to neighboring countries as well. Yeah, so I mean, of course, as the pandemic subsides, that may not be as important going forward, but I'm sure that with, I guess, these three priority areas, digital, health, and environment, these three will be kind of the, you know, the new focus of China going forward, shifting away from all those, like, you know, mega infrastructure projects. Yeah.
Okay, the BRI is expected to connect more than 70 countries, and of course this does boost the connectivity, as you explained earlier, and opening up opportunities for trade expansion. But in your opinion, do you feel that it has achieved some of its objectives thus far? Maybe you can take stock into the report card of the status of the Belt and Road initiatives up until now, before we jump into the whole idea of what's next for the Belt Road Initiative.
Sure. I mean, I guess if you just look at numbers, you know, in terms of trade and investment, I think that the Belt and Road Initiative has, I guess, progressed greatly ever since 2013. Around 150 countries have signed memorandums of understanding to join the Belt and Road Initiative. Between 2013 and 2020, China's investment in the BRI countries have actually increased at nearly 9% per year versus 6% for its total overseas investment. In terms of trade, the volume of trade between 2013 and 2022 between China and the BRI countries have doubled from $1 trillion USD to $2 trillion USD with an average annual growth of 8%. So I think this kind of points the evidence that indeed the BRI is helping to facilitate trade and investment between China and its beneficiary countries. if you look at the historical perspective. And I guess World Bank has some estimates that BRI transport infrastructure can reduce travel times for economies along transport corridors by up to 12%, and also increase trade by between 3 to 10%. So I think if you look at it from this perspective, I think that the BRI has indeed made great progress. In terms of what we will see going forward, I think that, I guess, as I said, the BRI will investments and construction flows will recover with the reopening, but it may not rebound to quickly to pre-pandemic highs. I think the small and beautiful slogan is the keyword to watch. We will see probably smaller scale projects, as I've been saying throughout this interview, less unbridled mega high infrastructure projects, and a shift towards a more targeted and strategic approach to enhance investments in the priority fields of green, digital, and also health. I think beyond the BRI, I think just this is, there's a general trend of China seeking more cooperation with especially ASEAN countries as it looks to preserve and strengthen the economic links with ASEAN. So as I said, there are other initiatives besides the BRI, like the Global Development Initiative, which I talked about earlier, the state-led development assistance. You've seen that last year, RCEP was signed and ratified. You see this trend going forward.
I'd be remiss if we don't touch a little bit about the geopolitical tensions that is currently happening globally. We saw Xi Jinping made a visit to Moscow to see Vladimir Putin. A few weeks ago, the US Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, did say that there is a possibility of China providing arms to Russia. The US has intensified their soft power experience here in ASEAN as well. I myself have interviewed the Undersecretary of the Secretary of State for ASEAN talking about this as well. Generally speaking, and of course the rising tensions, the ever-rising tensions, of course, between China and Taiwan, do you feel that these kind of scenarios are just going to aggravate further, and initiatives like the Belt and Road Initiative is going to be seen as an extremely crucial geopolitical point for China to expound on in order for them to win more friends, at least in this part of the region? Brian, where do you see the geopolitical tensions heading to, and how does the Belt Road Initiative is going to impact the political tensions right now?
I think the geopolitical tensions are probably here to stay. If anything, you have seen with all the news headlines that the US is indeed sees China as a competitor, essentially. There are all kinds of flashpoints, Taiwan being one of them. Probably for the next decade easily, I think that geopolitical tensions between US and China are going to be persistent. I think Belt and Road Initiative-wise, I guess in the context of rising geopolitical tensions, that's also partly why China won't just abandon Belt and Road like that, because that's a key initiative of it looking out to the world and in terms of its foreign policy. In terms of the impact of geopolitical tensions on Belt and Road Initiative, maybe China will be will assess more carefully who are the beneficiaries of this Belt and Road Initiative, and that then again rounds up to our goes back to our point that ASEAN I think is seen as a great hedge against geopolitical tensions, and China will look to ASEAN going forward, and whether it is in terms of this BRI or whether it is in terms of expanding trade and investment as well.
Taking ourselves away from the China point of view or lens, countries in ASEAN, we've always been, to use your own phrasing, hedge against global powers. We've always been tussled over by the great powers of the world. Singapore, one would argue, is more aligned to, say, for instance, the US. Other countries, not necessarily so, more aligned to China, maybe. How do you feel ASEAN is going to move forward as a bloc, considering that we all have economic needs to grow our own country respectively. Do you feel that ASEAN is going to seek more investments from China, or do you feel that we're going to go our own way and try to source for funds, especially from, say, neutral kind of sources? I don't know how else to put it. Where do you feel the ASEAN moving together as a bloc right now? Or do you feel that it's not going to move as a bloc? Everybody is out there for themselves. How do you see ASEAN together moving forward?
Well, I think ASEAN will continue to look to US as, like for their security arrangements. And but I think they see they are kind of cognizant of the rise of China and in terms of, attracting investments from China. But I don't think that they will just, you know, completely pivot to China. I think ASEAN will look to China, but also look to the US for investments. And I think that, and it will also look to, other developed countries, you know, Japan, Korea, and all that. It really depends on which country you're talking about. Yeah, so for instance, in Vietnam, there was this ISIS Yusof Ishak Institute State of Southeast Asia survey that was released in February this year that showed that especially in Vietnam, Thailand, and Philippines, respondents were worried about China's growing economic influence. And Vietnam has history of China in terms of the South China Sea disputes and all that. Vietnam might, has a policy of, you know, trying to hedge its bets. I mean, it kind of enhances, it looks to enhance relations with China, but at the same time, it looks to other countries. It looks to South Korea, the largest investor, look to, you know, even developed countries like Singapore, US as well. In terms of Singapore, my point is that it really varies between ASEAN countries. But I think that while I can't really predict the future, I think that the best way for ASEAN to do going forward is that you would actually kind of not want to take sides, but rather, you know, just try and remain more neutral. But at the same time, engage with both US as well as China.
Okay, now we leave the politics aside. By the way, I thought all economists' job is to predict the future, Brian. We now need to go down to the domestic issues of China per se. In your report, or in Maybank's report, it was written there that while direct investments fell in the pandemic years, China's balance of payments indicate that hidden capital flight may have risen during the pandemic years of 2020 and 2021. Residents is argued to have moved money abroad using unrecorded transactions, and there is a net error and emissions which reflects a flow that cannot be explained elsewhere. Do you feel that this situation is going to persist for 2023, or do you feel that China is getting to, tighten the screws in terms of this hidden capital flight, so to speak, domestically?
I think you do see that China's, because of China's zero COVID stance, do see Chinese taking some funds out of China, and that has contributed to and putting funds into, for instance, Singapore, in terms of investments in Singapore, property investments and so on. And that kind of has, as you said, contributed to the hidden capital flight. I think that it is in China's interest to tighten restrictions going forward. As China reopens and hopefully there's more confidence in China, there's more clarity from the leadership on its policies, then hopefully this hidden capital flight will kind of subside. At the same time, maybe policy driven as well, with more careful restrictions on the Chinese side.
Let's now deep dive into some of the projects that is currently being done in the ASEAN six countries of the BRI. You were mentioning just now the East Coast Rail Link in Malaysia. This is BRI's flagship program. It has undergone two reviews. Do you think that this will continue to be seen as favourable by this current administration led by Datuk Seri Anwar Ibrahim?
Well, so far the administration has said they will continue with the construction. I guess the assumption here is that things will progress. And I mean, after all, it is beneficial to Malaysia as well. And they have kind of you know, scaled down on the size of the loan, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, I mean, I think that it probably will continue going forward.
Okay, domestic discontent recipient countries like Cambodia and Laos was mentioned in your report. In terms of the forced relocation of rural communities, do you feel that these kind of hiccups and challenges need to be managed by the recipient countries better in order for them to receive more money from China for the Belt and Road initiatives?
Well, I think that this kind of like hiccups has kind of dampened sentiment towards the DRI in these ASEAN countries as well. Like you said, it gets domestic discontent with regards to the social impact, the impact on relocation of rural communities for BRI projects, the impact of on the environment, the impact on biodiversity as well. In terms of it's not just about how ASEAN countries need to manage this well, because not to forget that Chinese contractors are involved as well. So it's also about how you know, Chinese firms, Chinese contractors should actually manage and kind of mitigate these factors going forward as well, to ensure that BRI remains attractive. But that's it. With more renewable energy projects, with China setting up Kunming Biodiversity Fund, there are initiatives being introduced to kind of like see how these issues can be dealt with going forward. And I think China is actually quite cognizant of the negative spillover impacts of the BRI as well.
All right, Brian, final word before we conclude our conversation this morning.
Final comment, I mean, as I said, keyword to watch, small but beautiful. BRI will be a lot more strategic. It won't be just like the past where, you know, China just essentially like throws money at lots of mega infrastructure projects with less planning. I think there will be more strategic planning going forward. And I think that ASEAN stands to be a significant beneficiary. More cooperation will be sought between with ASEAN by China going forward. And I think it's important to watch the future ready fields, which are, you know, advantages to China and also a win-win situation for ASEAN in terms of digital transformation, in terms of environment, green projects, and also in terms of health. Yeah.
Thank you very much. That was Brian Lee joining us. He's an economist at Maybank Investment Banking Group. If you want to learn more on this, just head on to Maybank Investments website. There's the report that you can download. Also, you can go to astroin.com. There are plenty of news regarding this as well. My name is Ibrahim Sani. Catch you in the next one.